We all know that owning a small business means you wear many hats, but sometimes you really need an extra pair of hands. Upwork is how good companies find great and trusted freelance talent. With more than 2 decades of experience with the simple and ambitious goal of pioneering a better way of working, companies at every stage turn to Upwork to get things done and find more flexibility in staffing key projects and initiatives. They access a global marketplace filled with top talent in IT, web dev, marketing, and more. Posting a job on Upwork is easy. With no cost to join, you can register, browse freelancer profiles, and get help drafting a job post or even book a consultation. From there, you connect with freelancers that get you and can easily hire them and take your business to the next level. Visit Upwork.com right now and post your job for free. That's Upwork.com to post your job for free and connect with top talent ready to help your business grow. That's Upwork.com. Upwork.com.
Weight loss solutions are not one size fits all. Hers makes it simpler to get started and stick with a weight loss plan backed by expert guided online care that puts your weight loss goals first. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you, with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou, forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com. Apply.
Hello and welcome back. But this is a special episode. Today we will be joined by a special guest. But first, I want to thank, because I was cut off mistakenly in miscommunication, I want to thank all the super chats from last week, Mohammed, and especially Sammy, for your generosity. And welcome to Lone Wolf, a new subscriber to our YouTube community. I'm so glad you guys love the intro. We refuse to change it, A, because it took so much work, and B, because it's just too good. So I'm glad that you guys are still enjoying it. Once again, I'm asking you to read this book, End Times. We'll be talking about it again today. And I think that right now, and I hate that you guys are making me do this, but I'm going to have to recommend Noam Chomsky, Manufacturing Consent, and Parenti's Inventing Reality, because what's happening right now on the interwebs is insane. But first, Chris, my wonderful co-host, looking like a new man. Welcome. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. How are you doing? How's everybody tonight?
I'm good. I'm really excited for this stream. I haven't gotten to talk to Daniel in a long time, and I'm super interested in what he has to say about what's happening in the United States. And I think we have him here. So Daniel McAdams, welcome. He is the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity, a longtime libertarian voice and friend of the channel. Started off as foreign affairs advisor to Ron Paul, rock star Ron Paul. He's also a co-host of the Ron Paul Liberty Report podcast and a contributor to the Mises Institute. Daniel, how are you? It's really good to see you again.
Oh, thanks so much for having me back on. I'm sorry I screwed up my time, but I'm glad to be here now.
No worries. Good to have you.
So happy to have you. Well, I mean, everything is insane, and all of the tomfoolery is afoot. And you have a really keen eye for this kind of nonsense. So I really wanted to have you on it, and so you could give our viewers your insights. So I guess we'll just jump right into it. So with obviously the assassination of Charlie Kirk, the ongoing echoes of the attempts on President Trump last year, how do you see the surge in political violence reshaping American social fabric? And what role do you think libertarian policies or ideologies can contribute?
But contribute in a good way or a bad way?
Yes, to de-escalate the situation.
well, you know, I think that there is something very dark happening in the country right now. The hatred is spilling over, and it's sort of cliche to say this. Oh, there's so much anger. You know, I date it back probably to 2020 in the beginning of the COVID era. And I think that was the, regardless of what anyone feels about the virus, that was the beginning of the state wrapping its tentacles around a population worldwide and letting you know that it wasn't the shake of a warm, friendly hand, but rather something different. And I think that set tempers to blaze. And then you had, of course, the election of 2020, which a lot of people think wasn't a fair election. And I think in many ways, there's probably a lot to that. And then you had the spillover of January 6th, which, of course, the supporters of Biden wanted to make it look like the worst insurrection in history. The pro-Trump people wanted to make it look like a harmless protest. The reality, it was somewhere in between, probably closer to the harmless protest. But there are also a lot of BS going on, as we know now, around that whole thing. You know, were they let in? Were they allowed to do stuff? What was the role of Pelosi and others? So I think you had this anger building, and then you had through the 4 years of the Biden administration, you had an increasing anger. You had a president who wasn't capable of running the country. And then the country, particularly its foreign policy, was led by people who had the roots in the Obama era. And they were responsible for all of the terrible foreign policy in the Obama era, the murder, the overthrow and murder of Gaddafi, the destruction of Syria, the coddling of actual al-Qaeda to do its bidding in the region, the murdering of American citizens overseas, which Obama was good at, did it a few times. And I think he had all, you know, these people in charge, and they were left to do their own devices. And that's what they did. They went back to Ukraine and they also went back to the Middle East, where a lot of their hearts are. And you just had this building up of anger and frustration. And now with the assassination of Kirk, of Charlie Kirk, all of this is spilling out into the open and in the most insane way you can imagine. I guess we can get into it later, the rise of the woke right, which I'm always pilloried when I mention that. But that's what's happened. It's the same behavior that was rightly criticized when the left was doing it, now being not only utilized by the right, but weaponized by the right in a way that I think is much more damaging. So I'm sorry, that's a very long introduction to where we are. But I was just chatting with a Dutch friend of mine a little while ago, and he is, you know, looking at America from afar. And he also was saying there's something very terrifying about what's happening in the U.S. And he likens it to the people around a certain Austrian painter when he first seized power, the destruction of the SA, the people closest to him. And the same was true, of course, with Lenin. When he took power, the murder of the closest people to him. You kill the people closest to you first, and then you have concentric circles outward. I don't know if that's happening, but it certainly feels that way to a degree.
Interesting. I'm glad you said that, because we're going to get into that more. Again, guys, don't shoot the messenger, but Peter Turchin, I'm going to bring it up again. I don't know if you know of him. I'm sure you do, Daniel. But he shows that America's current assassination rate has exceeded the 1960s peak and is now approaching Civil War levels. Wow. His theories state that assassinations and terrorism are canaries in the coal mine. And he warns of an impending societal and structural breakdown, which is contributed to by the elite overproduction, the mass precarity, and what he calls the rise of moralistic punishers, who are people who lash out at a system they believe is fundamentally unjust. What do you make of the surge in assassinations and us approaching this level?
I didn't realize that. If that's true, it's pretty heavy duty. But, you know, it goes across. I mean, these things don't happen in a vacuum. You have an economic system that really is in full out collapse. We haven't noticed it yet, but you know, it's just like when the Soviet Union collapsed. It starts out slowly and then very quickly, and I think that's what we're seeing. You know, we're going to see where, you know, the Fed is desperate now to heed the decree of King Donald, and they've gone down, I think, 25 basis points today. Some wanted to go down 50. They're going to find out that they can't alter inflation rates to get us out of this mess of $37 trillion in debt, a 1.5 or more $1 trillion military budget every year and taking care of people at home. It's imploding. And I think with that implosion is going to come even more societal breaches and as we've seen, and more violence, which is what we're seeing.
You've often highlighted, Daniel, how U.S. foreign policy blowback contributes to domestic divisions. I think that's very pertinent today, and I think it's very important to understand. In light of the Kirk killing and the violence we've seen over the past few years and the rising extremist activity, is there a direct link in your mind between America's endless wars abroad and the quote-unquote long, dark history of violence at home? And I've mentioned this before, but I think it's worth repeating, that this is very much akin to Italy's years of lead, Gladio, the strategy of tension, and so much more that we've seen in the CIA's playbook in the Cold War period.
You know, I've told this story before, but I was I was working in out of Budapest in the 90s as an election and human rights monitor, and we were in a very unique position because we were on the ground for what I consider the very early color revolutions. They weren't called color revolutions at the time. I don't think that happened until even after Serbia in 99. They didn't acquire a color code. Maybe it was the Orange Revolution was the first.
It was Serbia. Serbia's the first one.
But these were the prototypes. Yeah, exactly. These were the prototypes of what was going to happen. And it was done according to very well thought out psychological processes developed by the military, probably from the 50s on, and it was put into play, and we saw it play out over and over again. I was in the middle of Albania in 96 when the U.S. decided to turn its back on Sali Berisha for interesting reasons, for him not cooperating with the U.S. war, U.S.-sponsored war in Yugoslavia. And then we saw in places like Slovakia where Mečiar refused to sell the VSZ steel a company in Košice to an American firm at fire sale prices, and that was his ouster. And you saw it elsewhere, certainly in Montenegro, I think it was 98, where you had to have Djukanovic, the young thrusting reformer, who just happened to be a smuggler and human trafficker with ties to Al-Qaeda. You just had to have him in because you couldn't dare elect the old polyester wearing Bulatovic, right, who wore old brown suits and talked about, his economic policy was on par with someone like a Lukashenko in Belarus. We don't want to destroy the economy and let people starve. We want to slow progress toward a closer to a market economy. And so he had to go because he wasn't willing to sell out his country. So I don't want to overtalk on this, but I mean, these were the kernels of what later became the application of violence became very important after that. And we saw that in Serbia. We certainly saw it at the Maidan in 2014. Violence became absolutely key to these events that started out relatively peaceful. But one of the things that we thought from the very beginning was this demon that we're unleashing overseas in the pursuit of a very specialized, special interest part of American foreign policy will be unleashed on our shores. This is a genie that's going to get out of the bottle and you can't put it back in. And I think that's what we're seeing, and that's what we've been seeing for quite some time here.
Streamers and podcasters and analysts, they're calling for unity on the right, which is interesting, an interesting concept. What does right-wing unity look like to you, and what are they unite? What are they going to unite under? And do you think there's an attempt to weaponize this moment?
How they're going to unite in getting some dog catcher fired because he shared something on the internet that wasn't. And I don't mean this to be too glib, but wasn't praying to Saint Kirk, this is really, I mean, someone even said it was a lawmaker, I forget who it was, that said if Charlie Kirk were around at the time of the apostles, he would have been the 13th. What the freaking hell is that all about? Excuse my language. I mean, I'm sure there were a lot of pleasant things about him. I didn't know him very well. If he was turning like Tucker and others are saying he was turning, well, that's certainly to be welcomed. And indeed may have been, unfortunately, the cause of his downfall, if that's the case. But unite around what? If anything, and I think this is probably the only little tiny micro white pill that we have, is that the right is fracturing more and more. You're seeing people speaking out like Tucker and Candace Owens and MTG is speaking out. Steve Bannon's not buying all. I don't completely trust him, but he's not buying all this crap. Matt Gaetz is also not buying it. So the fracturing, it is a civil war in the, not necessarily in the country, but a civil war on the right that we're seeing. And I think it really is, I don't want to over-dramatize it, but it's sort of like a battle for the soul of the country, I think, certainly of the right.
We're going to get into, this is where, we're going to get into the meme potatoes. I want both of your reactions to this clip. This is our Pam Bondi. I don't know, I mean, what is her job anymore? But here we go.
There's free speech and then there's hate speech. And there is no place, especially now, especially after what happened to Charlie, in our society.
Do you see more law enforcement going after these groups who are using hate speech and putting cuffs on people so we show them that some action is better than no action?
We will absolutely target you, go after you, if you are targeting anyone with hate speech, anything. And that's across the aisle.
Daniel, you know that we've been at the forefront of combating this and really fighting for the First Amendment and fighting for the protections of the freedom of speech. And listening to that, it seems exactly, as you pointed out earlier, a complete inversion of what we experienced just a few years ago and we're living in the midst of. What do you make of this and where do you think it's headed?
And can you imagine the audacity of someone who works for the American people saying, we're coming after you, we're going to target you? I mean, this is the language of East Germany. You know, this is the language of terror and tyranny. A and B, she obviously has no understanding of the First Amendment. She has no understanding of the Constitution. Even Matt Walsh, who I was on the Liberty Report today, and I said, it's very rare that I say something praising Matt Walsh. But he did come out and say she should be fired immediately for some, not just this, but the whole issue about this fellow who wouldn't print up a flyer. And the dude got fired and they apologized. But that wasn't enough because Bondi wants to go after someone. She's going to be even tougher than the boys out there. And it's terrifying. There's no, and anyone who stands up and says, well, hang on a minute. You can't just blow up boats in the middle of the ocean because you think they might have drug dealers on it. You can't just target people because of this or that. Oh, what are you? Are you some kind of liberal? Are you some kind of libertarian? You guys are losers. And this is the, I mean, it reminds me of actually the tone immediately after 9/11. That's how it was. And I remember my first reaction obviously was horror at what had happened. But the second thing that entered my mind is that the Palestinians are screwed because they're going to find a way to use it against them. And that's, I think, the history of the war on terror that we're now seeing the culmination of, then the utter destruction of the Palestinian people.
What do you think, Chris? You're in Moscow and you're watching, what we kind of always touted ourselves on. We have free speech and Russia doesn't. You can go to prison for being mean to Putin. What's it like for you to kind of watch this happening from Moscow?
I mean, I had a conversation. I had a great opportunity today. I sat with Rick Sanchez just a few weeks ago and we were talking and he really looked at me after done at the studio and we were right in Red Square. And he said, look, I have more editorial freedom here than I ever did at CNN, MSNBC and Fox News. And, you know, it's true. He said, and I saw him in the newsroom for an hour prep and an hour after. And he doesn't listen to anything. He does it his own way. And everybody understands that. I mean, that level of freedom of expression, of freedom of speech, it doesn't exist, especially in these narrow confines, especially in the mainstream media. And Daniel rightfully points it out in many places. And I think that also there is this idea that somehow, you know, there's a constriction of speech here in Russia and nobody can speak. No, there are people who are openly critical. There are people who are openly critical. There's a lot of that goes on. The question is degrees and how things are happening and what's in line. Of course, Russia is now at war and, you know, there's an active attempt to divide the country and to, you know, foment internal. I mean, the United States speaks about regime change. Think tanks have spoken about regime change and about, you know, balkanizing the country. So, but in general, it's very free here, very free to express yourself in a variety of ways. But there's this sort of like hate speech, this language of Pam Bondi. I have to agree with Daniel. It really harkens back to some of the worst, you know, sort of fascist repressive policies that we've seen in the 20th century. And I'm really concerned about where that's headed because you know, left and right, especially libertarians and, you know, even leftist socialists, communists, have united around this principle for a long time in U.S. history. They fought together because they knew if they didn't fight together, they would be picked apart one by one by a more oppressive government that was going after them for their perspectives. And that's the real fear, is that you're going to have a new wave of repression, of mass firings, of and forget about just cancel culture. People's lives are going to be destroyed in this process, and it's going to tear families apart. It's going to tear communities apart. And that's something that we have to realize. This is going to have long-term huge impacts for our society if it goes down the way that they are now pushing it.
I have a Tucker clip. Tucker and friends have been on quite the media tour, and I mean that in a positive way, but let's watch this clip, and I'll get from you and Daniel your thoughts.
A few days before he died, he lost a $2 million donation because he had publicly pledged to bring me to the next Turning Point conference in December. And he told me over the past couple of months, he was losing a lot of donations over that pledge. They put out a flyer basically saying that I was going to be at this event giving a speech. And so he would text me and say, man, I'm really taking a lot of heat for this and people are really mad. The American Jewish Committee called in a statement Charlie Kirk an anti-Semite and, quote, dangerous. Charlie was deeply offended by that and expressed some of those feelings on Megyn Kelly's show and in other places. But that did not let up. There was a huge effort by people, some of whom I know and have helped, and like Seth Dillon of the Babylon Bee, for example, someone who had his own problems with free speech, who was famously canceled. I like Seth Dillon. I had him on a couple of times. I had dinner with him to show support. Seth Dillon was out there demanding that Charlie Kirk take me off the roster, pull me off stage because I had said things that Bibi didn't like or that he didn't like or whatever. Shocking that someone whose whole persona is wrapped up in the idea that we all get to speak, and if you don't like it, make a more compelling case, that person and many others like him were advocating for me getting pulled off the stage because they don't like what I'm saying.
Unbelievable. So we have confirmation from Tucker Carlson, I guess everybody's up to who they want to believe at this point, but that Charlie Kirk lost $2 million donation just for inviting him to speak.
And I think Marjorie Taylor Greene said something similar as well, that she had been invited to debate AIPAC at the next gathering. It sounded to me like Charlie Kirk was discovering something that probably had been right under his nose the whole time. And he felt probably indignant. Like, I can't believe this. I thought these people were on the side of the white hats. The idea that I run a small nonprofit, $2 million donation. That's a lot of money. That's a lot of money. And, you think about, I feel the same obligation because I have people that work for me that have families. And I know that if I'm not able to raise the money, it's not just my family that suffers, but I know other people. And I can only imagine how must have been for Charlie, who had so many employees and so many people who were depending on him being able to bring those donations home. That must have been agonizing. And I think Tucker captured some of that in some of the other things that he said about how agonized Charlie was toward the end.
Chris?
I think you're absolutely right. How do you talk about free speech on the right in this climate at this point? And how do you think, is there any movement left that isn't ruled by fear, donor pressure, foreign entanglements? Where do you see this heading in terms of free speech tied to a lot of these financial interests, not only from foreign governments, but also from massive tech monopolies that are not accountable to the government and they're not accountable to the American people ultimately?
Well, Colonel Doug McGregor talks a lot about this, about incredibly wealthy financial people for whom a foreign state overseas, Israel, is their primary target. And now we've just seen that Ellison is going to buy, from reports that we're seeing, is going to buy TikTok. And he's given billions. He's given certainly millions to the IDF. He bought CBS for his son to give to Barry Weiss. He's, I think, trying to buy CNN. Mm-hmm. This is a guy who is absolutely fanatically dedicated to a foreign country. If anyone believes that he will allow any criticism of that country on any of his networks, you know, I've got a waterfront property in Lake Jackson here to sell you. You know, it's just not going to happen. So you have this kind of convergence of incredibly wealthy people who have incredible amounts of power, and for some reason are absolutely dedicated to the survival of this small country overseas. And now there are plenty of American Jews who absolutely reject the idea of Zionism, and a lot of them are our friends, and we know them. But then you have this fanatical group. It almost seems like something out of, I don't know, the Middle Ages or something, that they're so obsessed with this issue and they have a lot of power.
Okay, so we'll get into the, we've seen the explosion, the allegations from, I call them allegations, it sounds bad, but from Owens and Candace Owens and Max Blumenthal. So that they talk about a secret Hamptons meeting where Bill Ackman, whom I'm sorry, I can't stand Bill Ackman, absolutely makes my skin crawl, horrible person. He allegedly confronted Kirk over his growing criticisms of Israel, or maybe participating in AIPAC debates with Marjorie Taylor Greene or whatever. And I'm going to play the clip for our listeners or our viewers just so they could get a refresher. But then he appeared on Megyn Kelly immediately following this Hamptons influencer retreat for the Israeli conscience. I don't know, but here's the clip.
We're just going to try to, we're going to just stamp out everything type of practice. But it goes to the point where if, for example, if I have less ability sometimes online to criticize the Israeli government without backlash than actual Israelis do. Mm-hmm. And that's really, really weird, isn't it, Megan? That's
not so right. Wrongheaded. I'll tell you this for me. So I got some blowback after saying Mossad possibilities with Epstein, a comment behind which I stand. I mean, I realize, and I've, of course, reported what Alan Dershowitz has said as his lawyer. He says, I think he would have told me. He didn't say he had any of those connections. I hear all that. That doesn't mean it's not true. I think all these things should be explored. It's one of the many things that should be explored around Epstein. But saying that, and also saying he might be a U.S. asset, et cetera, doesn't make you anti-Semitic.
So do you, what do you think about the meeting, the kind of the I don't want to say narrative, but the story or the timeline that Candace and Max have been kind of putting, piecing together through their media appearances and writing?
Pretty compelling, isn't it? You know, I mean, obviously you want, you know, we all sort of want to see it, you know, this event for what we want to see, you know. Mm-hmm. To me, it looks like, I mean, how should I put this? They're not going to kill someone who's already gone over to the other side. If there's a they, and if they killed him, if it's not just this trans attracted fellow, whatever, Patsy, they're not going to take out someone who's already seen the light, you know, like a Candace or what have you. Hope to God they don't. But it's someone who's turning that has, I mean, look, okay, here's what we know. We know from all the polls this year that young conservatives are turning against Israel. There was the Pew poll. There was the Gallup poll. There have been follow-up polls where we see Republicans 18 to 40 who in the majority do not support Israel. I've never seen that in my lifetime. No. That is an absolute shift. And they're having obviously a panic attack. And Netanyahu himself said, we got to do something about TikTok. We got to do something about the youth. You know, and he wasn't talking about, you know, selling them a better product, a kinder, gentler Israel. He was talking about pounding them in the head until they start seeing the light, or simply just banning all of their outlets. So we're seeing a shift. We're seeing a person who probably exerts the most influence over young conservatives in the entire country himself, according to his good friends, having a crisis of conscience on some of the things that he's said in the past and the way he's felt in the past. You know, again, total speculation, but if he's taken out now, he becomes a hero. And that's exactly what, I mean, Israel is behaving like the guy who was, you know, caught with a knife in his head, like the guy with the hammer when Pelosi's husband was, you know, beat up. I mean, you know, I mean, that's how they're acting. I didn't do it. I didn't do it. We didn't do it. We loved him. We loved him, you know. And then you sit and you turn on the Charlie Kirk show and you have, you know, all of these pro-Israel, the panel on there these days. You have Ben Shapiro taking over, and someone made a funny meme. Maybe it's inappropriate for your audience, but Ben Shapiro and the others around there, and it had the you know, the great meme of the Israeli guy said, if we don't steal your show, somebody else is going to steal your show. So,
I saw that.
Yeah, it was great. It was great.
Amazing.
So, yeah, I mean, you piece it together and it makes sense. But again, it could be confirmation bias. Who knows? I don't know.
That's also true. Well, you've been in the political, those sort of circles, that sort of spheres for decades. Is this unprecedented? Is this kind of like, are you used to hearing about these dark meetings and money pressure and stuff like that? Or is this like on hyper overdrive?
Yeah. I mean, I know about these meetings. I was, I don't want to be too specific, but I mean, I had a fellowship with an organization that was definitely very strongly in the pro-Israel camp, and it was understood that you would be that way, and certainly on Capitol Hill. If you were in an office that wasn't considered to be completely 100% loyal, then you were ostracized, and that's how we were at Ron Paul's office. We weren't hostile. In fact, I mean, to my shame, I refused to meet with what's her name, Rachel, the gal that got destroyed by the bulldozer.
Corey.
I refused to meet with her family because I said, look, I don't want to get involved in this. You know, I don't need any more trouble. And I was a coward, to a degree. So, but that was certainly the case there, and I'm sure it's way worse now. I've been out for 12 years. I'm sure it's way worse now.
Yeah, actually, it's kind of spooky. Go ahead, Chris.
No, I was going to say that it's very scary. Some of the unelected, ungovernable, there's no ability, there's no transparency. There's no ability to vet these people. There's no way to hold them accountable for their actions. And I know that people like to use terms, shadow state, deep state, or whatever. But there is a vast unelected body of both bureaucrats and influencers and lobbyists, both foreign lobbyists and domestic lobbyists, who do this kind of work. And I think that part of, I think, the struggle, and I think that this is where we find a lot of common ground between libertarians and, you know, those of us on the left, is that we want to hold these people accountable. We want more transparency, more accountability for these people, or we want to just get rid of them altogether in a lot of ways. These lobbyists are unnecessary. They're completely, stealing and really hijacking the democratic ways of governance that we're supposed to have outlined in the Constitution. What do you make of that?
And it's not just Israel. I mean, it's in the focus now because of all the things that are happening. But I remember on the Hill, I was on the Hill doing foreign policy when the Magnitsky laws were up for big debate, you know, and honestly, this is the absolute truth. The entire Magnitsky momentum, these were the restrictions on Russia. This is really the pre-Russia gate. You know, we want to stir up the hate again. It was driven by one civil servant in one extremely obscure government bureau. And I don't want to name names for obvious reasons, but this single person, it was singular in this person's mind to push Magnitsky. And he could not be stopped. And so if you have just a couple of people that are like that, Lenin understood that very, very well. You want to have a dedicated minority. You don't want to have the majority. He was brilliant in that. And that's exactly what you have in D.C. And that's how things get done.
Well, Max Blumenthal has been on a media blitz, thankfully. I've been appreciative of it. But he was on InfoWars yesterday. He said a lot about the government in addition to the Charlie Kirk analysis. But leading into this clip I'm going to show, he mentioned the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, which was obviously attributed to, probably rightfully so, to Netanyahu. But he had a lot more to say, too.
So this is a merciless character who's carrying out assassinations across the region, including inside a U.S. ally. And going back to what I was telling you before the break, John Ratcliffe, when he was isolated with Donald Trump to basically feed Donald Trump Mossad talking points, including about phony, fabricated WMD propaganda about the Houthis about to get a nuclear weapon from Iran if he didn't strike. He was isolated by Susie Wiles, the chief of staff. And who is Susie Wiles? Subsequent to my report at the Gray Zone citing a inside White House source, a Trump official, we learned that Susie Wiles had actually went to Israel to work for Benjamin Netanyahu on his 2020 reelection campaign. How crazy is that? America first and your chief of staff literally worked for a foreign leader? What's going on here? I mean, that's what we're unmasking is the biggest foreign influence infiltration operation in American history that is basically taking control of an administration that says it's America first and is taking us to a very dangerous place. And everybody's concerned about it, including for on the left, on the right. And we're also concerned about where we're being taken in this country with the violence, with the social unrest. We're all being pitted against each other by murky forces. It seems like whatever happened here, the killer's identity and politics has already been determined.
I want to focus on where he says how infiltrated we are. So the chief of staff of our American administration was working for Netanyahu, and the CIA is taking intel orders from Mossad. This is worse than anything that we were told it was going to be. I mean, this is just, it's unbelievable. We knew about Susie Wiles' connections to Netanyahu, but I don't know. What are your thoughts?
I mean, in a way, I mean, this is worse than Biden. You know, Biden, he could be manipulated because for certain reasons, he was kind of an empty vessel. But Trump is an even better candidate because he's profoundly incurious about anything. We know that he repeats the last thing he's heard. He doesn't seem to understand basic concepts. He simply repeats what he's been told. So if you are someone who has a very strong interest, special interest, you get him isolated. And we know very well that Radcliffe has been in his entire career an absolutely fanatical Christian Zionist. He subscribes to a philosophy, to an end times philosophy that many people find extremely, extremely extreme. So he gets Trump isolated and starts feeding him stuff that's totally crazy. And you have Trump openly contradicting Tulsi Gabbard, who was going with the intelligence community line that has been the line since 2006, I think it is, maybe 03 even. And all of a sudden here comes Radcliffe saying, no, we've got new info. That's not true at all. Well, Max is right. That info came straight from the Mossad, and it was fed to him by Radcliffe. So that talk about foreign influence at the very, very highest level.
I got to ask you, Daniel, in your opinion, is this the most deeply foreign influence administration that you've seen and we've seen in modern U.S. history?
Absolutely. I mean, every single figure in the Trump administration, not only the top tier, not cabinet level, but second, third, fourth, and fifth tier. Look what they did in the Pentagon a few months ago when they cleared out, I think there was three aides at like, you know, three or four tiers down. Was it Dan Caldwell, I think, was one of them. And these were not radical libertarian peaceniks. These were guys who were basically realists saying, hey, maybe a war with Iran is not a great idea right now. They were kicked out. And so this has penetrated all the way down. But I don't think it happened overnight. I think we've seen this has been happening administration after administration, this infiltration of our foreign policy and even now our domestic policy, because we are becoming, there's an Israelification of our domestic policy as well.
We're going to get into Kash Patel. He's been strutting his stuff on the floor of Congress. It's abysmal, but this is my favorite part.
After remembering your oath to tell the truth, did you ever tell Donald Trump his name is in the files?
I have never spoken to President Trump about the Epstein files.
Did you ever tell the Attorney General that Donald Trump's name is in the Epstein files?
The Attorney General and I have had numerous discussions about the entirety of the Epstein files and the reviews conducted by our team.
Did you tell the Attorney General that Donald Trump's name is in the Epstein files?
And we have released where President Trump's name is in the Epstein files.
It's a simple question. Did you tell the Attorney General that the President's name is in the Epstein files?
during many conversations that the Attorney General and I have had on the matter of Epstein, we have reviewed.
The question is simple.
Who
did you tell the Attorney General that Donald Trump's name is in the Epstein files? Yes or no?
Why don't you try spelling it out?
Yes or no, Director?
Use the alphabet.
Yes or no?
No? A, B, C,
Director,
E, F?
It sounds like you don't want to tell us. Did you tell the Attorney General that Donald Trump's name was in the Epstein files?
Why don't you try serving your constituency by focusing on reducing violent crime in this country and the number of pedophiles that are legally harbored in sanctuary cities in California? I'll work with you on that.
Regular order, Mr. Chairman.
I belong to the gentleman from California.
Did you tell the Attorney General that Donald Trump's name is in the Epstein files?
The question has been asked and answered.
You've not answered it, and we will take your evasiveness as a consciousness of guilt.
Cash Patel is so trash, he's going to have me liking Eric Swalwell. Like, what are we doing?
That's what I was thinking. I need a shower. I need a shower. Whoa. Like, yeah.
Like, you've never spoken to Trump about the Epstein files?
And I thought there was no such thing as the Epstein files, though. What were they talking about? If they don't exist, then what the hell were they talking about? What files? That's what he should have said, maybe. The only thing I will say in Patel's defense is I do love seeing when a witness refuses to be bullied by a grandstanding member, you know, that happens a lot. And so that little flash of temper was warranted. However, again, he did not handle himself very well in that because it was an impossible question.
I'll come deal with the pedophiles in your sanctuary cities while I cover up this huge pedophile ring over here. Mm-hmm. They're all crazy. Yeah. Go ahead.
Never mind just domestic pedophile ring, an international one, taking Israelis, Brits, Saudis, you name it. They were all involved. It's crazy. It's crazy. Daniel, I want to get your thoughts on Cash Patel's overall handling of the FBI, the assassination of Charlie Kirk, and what's ongoing so far, and also the Epstein case, which is still the elephant in the room for many Americans.
Yeah, and the Americans missed the main point, you know, because they get sucked into the salaciousness, you know, the pedophilia and all this, which is obviously horrible. But that's not the point. The point is the blackmail side of it. We talked a couple of minutes ago about how deeply penetrated our foreign policy is. Well, maybe this was a tool to enable that to happen over the last decade or so, you know? And so that part, the Republicans don't want to think about that part. They only want to obsess about the salaciousness, you know, and I get it. Okay. But let's, you know, let's get beyond that and see what it's really about, you know, the theft of our country. And that's what it's about. But the Cash Patel thing with this assassination was bizarre. And he's been lampooned so much on X, it's hilarious. I think maybe it was even the Babylon Bee that said, he's asking the shooter's parents to help solve other crimes, you know, because he jumps out in front and says how great the agency is and how great all the law enforcement is. The dude gave himself up. You didn't do anything.
Catch him. What did both of you make? I went viral yesterday. Thanks, Matt Walsh.
That was crazy. I saw you reposted you. You're in danger. You're going mainstream on us, Sarah. You're going mainstream.
What do you do that? Anyway, what did you think about that text message exchange? That was my knee-jerk reaction. So I saw it, I read it, and then I read it out loud. And then I was like, who talks like this? Especially a Zoomer. I haphazardly underlined some stuff and posted it. But what did you guys think about that exchange?
Oh, ChatGPT, write me a text exchange where every single aspect of the crime is spelled out perfectly, including the wrapping of the gun in a towel. You know, I mean, they're getting lazy at the FBI. You know, they're not even writing it out themselves. I thought it was absurd when I first read it. And I thought, wow, this is crazy.
Well, Chris, you talk to a lot of Zoomers. Do you think Zoomers wrote those texts?
Absolutely not. I don't even write that way even to my loved ones.
My love.
No, yeah, like sweetie, honey, blah, blah, blah. You know, I don't know. Like, this is not a normal way. Like, it's so robotic. It's so formalistic. And of course, Daniel's right. It gives away every detail that's necessary for a court of law to bring about charges and to start moving this case forward.
My love, I'm so sorry. I don't want you involved and I don't want you to incriminate you, but I'm going to tell you every detail about this case and my escape, my love.
Can I be honest? One thing that really stuck out to me, and I don't know if it stuck out to you all, but I'm sure you were able to kind of think about it, popped in your mind. 1 week to plan. This,
yeah, yes.
Daniel, let's hear this out. You had 1 week to plan a complex operation, an assassination of a public figure, of a public intellectual in a university campus with a rifle, with a plan. Understanding, first and foremost, how do you have access to the information about where to go? How did you have access to the rooftop? I mean, I've been to many universities, I have multiple degrees. I don't have access to the rooftop of these facilities. You need card access. There's a whole bunch of things. You need to have keys. I mean, maybe if he was working as a part-time janitor, I could understand that, but we have no evidence of that at this point. How did you plan this entire thing in 1 week from start to finish, properly executed? What do you think, Daniel?
That stuck out at me as well. And I think he lived 5 hours away.
Yeah,
so it's not like he's hanging out on campus. There would be something. Now, we know that he liked camping. He kind of liked the outdoors and all this stuff. But there would have to be something extraordinary in his background. In my opinion, my amateur opinion, there would have to be something extraordinary that would convince you that, as you say, in 1 week, you'd seem like, you know, SEAL Team 6 would need 6 weeks at least to, you know, maybe this guy's the guy who blew up the Nord Stream 2. I mean, he may just train for a week in scuba diving and there you go.
Well, I got to ask both, all of this insanity, the lists, the losing of the jobs, the attacking one another, who benefits?
Yeah, what do you think?
I'm trying to make you guys say it. This is for the viewers, not for me. I know the answer.
I think that's exactly what anything to take the attention off of the things that Max is saying and the things that Tucker is saying, that there's a lot of weird stuff here. If I could step back just one step, and I'll try to be really brief on this, but I think the bigger picture and the bigger problem, and this is a longer term problem, and my friend Jeff Dice, my former colleague in Ron Paul's office, said talks about this more eloquently than I'd be able to. But the problem is that politics is now taking up a much larger portion of our lives, and we care much more about it than we used to. Now, I remember I moved to Hungary right after communism fell, so there was still a very strong sense of what the system was like. And my dear friend who escaped after 1956 to the U.S., he came to visit me once, and his family was evenly divided between those who had joined the party and those who hated the party. And to that day, even after, you know, everything was said and done, those two sides of the family, very close relatives, hated each other's guts because of politics. And I remember thinking at the time, now this is in the early 90s, thank God we're not like that here. You know, there are a few hotheads, but generally speaking, I mean, I went to high school in the 80s. We didn't know who was conservative and who was liberal. It didn't really matter. You had a little bit of an inkling, but it's become so important now in our lives to the finest detail that we actually kill people over or get someone to lose their jobs over it. It's unthinkable. So that's the real root of the problem, I think.
I have to agree. And I have to say, in terms of who benefits, I mean, the elite, the call it what you want, the oligarchy, the plutocracy, the ruling class, whatever it might be, they're the ones that ultimately benefit. The interests that have a stake and a claim to increase their power, not only politically, but also economically, militarily, they're the ones that ultimately benefit from this kind of chaos. Because while we're busy fighting and canceling one another and things like that, they're bombing multiple sovereign countries and nobody's stopping them. Nobody's stopping them. We just had Israel violate the sovereignty of a seventh country, Qatar, to bomb Hamas's diplomatic quarter. It doesn't, their headquarters, it doesn't matter what you think of Hamas. This is a violation of international law, international norms and standards. It's something that shouldn't be tolerated. But conveniently, forget about not just forgetting the Epstein stuff. We forget all of the crimes of what's going on in Israel. Israel's basically annexing the West Bank at this point. Israel's on the move. And we have a whole new international situation. We have a slow erosion of all of the goodwill between Russia and the United States at this point in Ukraine. I think that we're going to see escalation there as well. And I think that the Europeans are continuing their war footing against the Russian Federation. We're seeing provocations in Latin America. I mean, Daniel rightfully points out, we're just destroying boats with people in them without any idea of what's going on. No idea of what's going on. Daniel, you and I mean, I'm old enough. I got my real, you know, teeth in the movement in 2003, really fighting against the buildup to the Iraq war. I come with the Iranian family. We knew that this whole thing was botched. We said, you gave chemical weapons to Saddam. He destroyed them and he used them against Iranians. So you have all the receipts. You have Rumsfeld on camera shaking Saddam's hand in the 80s. So we knew that the whole thing was a farce. And now I'm just... We've had a massive movement for Palestine, but you see that the fear, the destruction of people's lives and things like that, it's really changed the movement. And so for my final question, I want to ask you, because we've been in this for a long time, especially fighting against these endless wars, U.S. militarism, 800 plus foreign bases, you name it. And you're just saying the wealth of this great country, this great republic, is just being spent elsewhere instead of on the people. What do you make of the state of the United States at this point? And how do you think the American people can turn the clock back or can fast forward to something better, can change the dynamics? What's in your mind? What are you thinking these days, especially if you have kids, grandkids, and you're thinking about their futures?
I'll just say as an aside, I'm actually the one who leaked the banking committee documents to Bob Novak back at the time that showed how the U.S. had provided chemical weapons to Iraq. He did a column about it. It was one of my few victories on the Hill.
Thank you for that.
There was nothing classified. It's just that it was right there out in the open. So I called up my good friend Bob and said, "You want to run with this?" And he said, "Yep." So there's that. And by the way, I have a 25-year-old and a 20-year-old child. And so they're also we're homeschoolers and we're more conservative. But even considering that, they would not talk like that. They don't. They're the ones that taught me all these little shortcuts and, you know, all this stuff. So in that case. But yes, I think we're absolutely moving. And you're right. You're absolutely right, because the elites are getting fabulously wealthy. And I started our conference last month, the Ron Paul Institute conference in DC, by saying, you know, I flew into DC Reagan Airport over McLean, and I flew in looking at these unbelievably gorgeous mansions with well manicured lawns and multi acres, you know, in McLean and all of this. These are the people who are the heart of the military industrial complex that keep getting richer, that keep us in wars. And in the meantime, working class, middle class America, we're the ones that get screwed. We're the ones that go to the store. And I mean, if you think about inflation, it's absolutely insane. We're getting screwed. We're getting squeezed so they can get richer and keep with advancing their wars, doing the bidding of foreign countries. I think we're headed for a crash. I mean, I hope something happens before then. I personally, I'm not a libertarian, and RPI is not a libertarian organization. I just want to get that through, but I'm familiar enough with the arguments that I can make them and understand them. I don't think libertarians are winning right now. I think they've been steamrolled by the Trump administration to get into office in the first place, and now they're basically shutting up. I think there was a short period of time where they were able to influence culture and policy. Right now is not that time. So I don't know what can stop a collapse, and I think it will be an economic collapse first, and it's going to be, I think, very, very ugly.
We're at the end, but I have to ask, we've discussed assassination, surveillance, lobbying, censorship. As both of you, I guess, do you think that this is the final phase of the empire? Or do you think it could be something that's much worse, like the system's not collapsing, it's just sort of morphing and adapting to survive by silencing like dissenters? And this goes for both of you, even though you might not be in the same political ideology. Do you believe that non-interventionist anti-establishment voices like you guys will survive? Or do you think that that door is closed?
Like physically? You're scaring me.
I don't mean that. I guess I shouldn't talk like that right now. I'm so sorry. Endure. I mean, it's, I'll say endure.
It's unintentionally accurate, to be honest, you know, and I do wonder about that. Someone even asked me the other day, and I said, well, thank God I'm not important enough to be a threat to anyone. I just, you know, I'm just someone who talks a lot. You know, I do have great fear, and I don't think here's the thing. Okay, let's watch if Trump puts the 100% secondary sanctions on India and China. That's when you're going to see the collapse happen, I think. Already, I was reading an article in Zero Hedge this morning about how coffee is through the roof. It's through the roof. And it talked about, oh, well, we had some bad climate issues and bullshit. You know what I'm saying? It's the freaking tariffs. 50% tariffs on Brazil. That's why the coffee's expensive. And it's going to get worse if he keeps doing this. And that'll be the collapse. That'll bring it on, I think.
Daniel, I have to agree with you. I mean, we're not only looking at the tariffs and sort of the economic conditions, but we're seeing, I mean, this buildup in the Caribbean. We have the United States is dealing with an immigration issue that it's currently dealing. You have an entire debate, the questions about the border. You have National Guard deployed to the border. You have people with like their local militias trying to surveil the border. Can you imagine if you destroy the state of Venezuela? What will happen in Latin America? I mean, we're talking about rampant destabilization. Okay, I'm not saying that the U.S. has to agree with the Venezuelan system. They don't have to choose that system if they don't want it. But to go and decapitate, for example, the government of Venezuela, as some are advocating for, to launch strikes against President Maduro, who I just shook the hand of just, you know, 2 months ago. I mean, it's just insane. It's not sane foreign policy. And it's exactly the problem that brings us back to the crisis that we're in, that we just go without thinking like a bunch of, you know, in like Western movies, we're going to go and we're going to shoot first and ask questions later. The problem is that we already know what's going to happen after we shoot. It's all right. It's not rocket science. It's simple history. We know what's happened. And we know that in Afghanistan, we spent trillions. The Taliban is stronger today than they ever were before. We spent trillions in Iraq. And now you have the government that's there that wants to throw out the U.S. I mean, all of the, we're not in a good business of state building. We're not in the business of taking over unless we want to be a colonial power again and spend all of our money and resources to rape and pillage these countries and to take them over and to add to our territory. But we're not in that business anymore, at least not to what I think American people want. I think there are some in government who want that and who want to expand and turn Gaza into, you know, the Riviera on the Middle East, you know, on the Eastern Mediterranean there. But I think that this is a huge crisis, and you're absolutely right. It's going to start economically because of the trade war, a lot of the financial issues that are going on. Also, just the systemic issues that have not been resolved, not only with the debt, but there are other bubbles that exist at this point. The housing market, you have the student loans, you have an enormous amount of debts that need to be serviced outside of even the government debt. Yep. And these are huge, major issues that are also in private hands as well. And I think that compounding that, the military situation and the political situation, the geopolitical situation, the development of BRICS, the multipolar world, we really are headed to a very profound crisis where the U.S. ultimately will have to decide, do we want to maintain our hegemonic unipolar status and spend everything and start to throw everything at it? Or will we accept that the reality has changed and we have to figure out a way to be in this new world order and to figure out a way to cooperate with other countries? Those are the only two choices that I can foresee at this point.
Or we keep getting people fired for saying bad things about Charlie Kirk. That's where we're heading.
Yeah.
So idiocracy is real. It is real.
It is.
Well, right. I think that's all we have. Daniel, tell our audience where they can find you, what you're working on, who you're trolling, et cetera.
Oh, no. Well, I can't have a sharp tongue on. I mean, I've been radicalized and pissed off by what's happening in Gaza. So I have to admit it, you know, and I've got kids. I can't stand seeing kids getting blown up. It makes me so mad. So I do take it out sometimes on there. But for the Ron Paul Institute, you know, we're ronpaulinstitute.org. I do a live show with Dr. Paul Monday through Thursday at noon Eastern time. We just had our annual DC conference last month. Our conferences are always great because they draw a such a wide range of great people. You know, we did actually have Max and his wife Anya speak at our conference this year. We had Jeffrey Sachs speak. We had on the other side, we had Colonel McGregor speak. We had Nassim Nicholas Taleb speak at the event. We had, you know, it's just, they're just great events for people to get together. And so we do usually two or three a year. So we love to have people come and show up and meet other people, because that is actually one way. And Chris, you're right. That's one way to defeat them, is we have to get together physically and get to know each other and talk. And that's why I don't want to put a conferences. I don't want to stream them. I want people to be in the room. I want to go analog.
I think most of us are heading that way. The more analog, the better at this point. Well, thank you so much, Daniel. It has been a pleasure. And I'm sure we will talk to you again when we lose more of our free speech.
Thank you, Daniel.
Look forward to it. Take care. Great talking to you guys.
You too.
Great talking to you.
Thank you all for joining us today for our special episode. And thank you so much to our new member, Lone Wolf Survivor. We will keep up the great work. Chris, do you have any final thoughts?
Just everyone stay safe. Hard keep up words. The good work. Keep up the good work. Keep your minds open. Keep your, you know, I would say pens sharp, but keep your fingers agile over there. This war is not only in the real world, but also in the digital space. So make sure that you're out there as the good partisan that you are, and we'll continue to fight and bring you the latest on all of these pressing issues. Keep an open mind and let's keep going.
That's most important. Keep an open mind, keep your head on a swivel, and look and ask yourself who benefits from a huge division between the left and the right, or the black and the white. It's the moneyed class. So that's who's pushing these divisions. And everybody stay safe. I will just say, I hate to say this, but watch what you say online. It's insane out there. But be careful, stay safe, and we'll see you guys on Sunday.